Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Home Interrupted, a new podcast from our partners at Feet in Two Worlds. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to Whoa!
Potluck. And welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here to discuss our August 2019 book club pick, Severance, by Ling Ma.
As always, this is your spoiler warning. We are going to spoil the hell out of this book.
Yeah.
But if you do not care, you know, feel free to keep listening.
Right. And if you do care, just push pause right here, read the book. It's a pretty breezy read. And then come back and listen to our thoughts. And as always, you can share your own thoughts about the book on our Goodreads forums. Just go to goodreads.com and search Books and Boba. Join our group. And if you can't introduce yourself, we always love to learn more about the people that read along with us.
But we're going to start with the jacket description.
Let's jump right in.
The jacket description, as always, is Candace Chen, a millennial drone self-sequestered in a Manhattan office tower, is devoted to routine. With the recent passing of her Chinese immigrant parents, she's had her fill of uncertainty. She's content just to carry on. So Candace barely notices when a plague of biblical proportions sweeps New York. Then Shen fever spreads, families flee, companies cease operations. The subway screeches to a halt. Her bosses enlist her as part of a dwindling skeleton crew with a big end date payoff. Soon entirely alone, still unfevered, she photographs the eerie, abandoned city as the anonymous blogger New York Ghost. Candace won't be able to make it on her own forever, though. Enter a group of survivors led by the power-hungry IT tech Bob. They're traveling to a place called the Facility, where Bob promises they will have everything they need to start society anew. But Candace is carrying a secret she knows Bob will exploit, should she escape from her rescuers. And we'll just jump right in. Marvin, what did you expect and how? What were your overall impressions?
I mean, when you pitched this book to me, you said it was a millennial, like, zombie narrative
story. Yeah, kind of, yeah.
And I didn't really know what to expect going in. Maybe something along the lines of, like, a comedic take, like Shaun of the Dead or Zombieland. But it turned out to be a zombie story tailored specifically to millennial angst and anxieties, in addition to children of immigrant angst and anxieties, like all into one. And I was really surprised, but really like fascinated by it just while I was reading the story. And there were a lot of parts that I can relate to and a lot of parts that like it really made me think about a lot of things critically that I did not expect to be doing for the story.
Yeah, same here. I didn't really know what to expect. From what I had gleaned from other people who have read it, it's like it's very dry humor. It's black comedy, and I was like, okay, maybe it's like Chemistry by Wiki Wang, which is also like told from a Chinese American woman's point of view who's kind of going through a rut with her job and trying to like figure things out. And I was like, okay, like. I really like that type of tone, so I'm pretty sure I'm going to be really into this because, you know, post-apocalyptic plus, like, dry humor and plus, like, millennials, like, freaking out over what they want to do with their lives and, like, capitalism anxiety. Like, this is all, like, a perfect storm for me. So I really, really liked it. I felt like this book was, like, almost electric. There was so much like sensory going through me when I was reading it. And I mentioned in the previous episode, but this really like pumped up my nostalgia for New York.
It's interesting because I thought Ling Ma did a really great job taking that framing of the zombie narrative and applying it to the current day, or at least our generation, where you can recognize that like the things that the undead are doing in this narrative are things that us as millennials are like the most afraid of.
Yeah, it's right? Like what's the difference between us and the fevered? We're doing the same things over and over again. There's a repetition to our day that makes us feel dead inside.
So I guess, how do you want to tackle that? There's so much I want to talk about, but we should endeavor to have a structured conversation. So, I mean, I guess we can start talking about just how this book is set up, right? There's like, it's a dual narrative, time-shifted,
yeah,
I guess.
There's definitely some time jumping. So mm-hmm. the book opens up with Candace already in the group of survivors, mm-hmm. and then it jumps to her living in New York. She doesn't have a job yet. And she's with her college friends, and you kind of know her background of being an orphan.
Right. So one story takes place in 2011, the year that the outbreak happens and society breaks down. And the other story takes place in 2006, which is when
she just moved to New York.
They just graduated college. It's interesting because that's when I graduated college too. So I was like, okay, these are people my age. and I think something that's interesting about the way the book was written is it's all in past tense, right? Because the first sentence of the story is there were nine of us and that would go down, right? So, and like we mentioned, like the book itself, I read it on Kindle, so I didn't have the experience, but the book itself, the physical book itself is packaged as like a journal, right?
It's like this strawberry milk colored, cover with like a little tear in like the top part of the book where it looks like newspaper, but I haven't like seen it up close. But it looks like writing. So it's like this perfectly packaged millennial book cover with like something more, I guess, like more depth inside, but we talked about consuming. This book is about consumerism. There's like so much brand dropping in this book, and so much of it is associated with status. And it kind of reminded me of Crazy Rich Asians, but it was done well.
I mean, there's that, but there's also like, you know, a lot of foodie terms, a lot of just like when you think about millennial New Yorkers, right? A lot of these things come up. I mean, as someone who did spend their early 20s in New York, tell me about your experience reading this.
It's funny because you said that you graduated from college in 2006. Mm-hmm. I left New York City in 2011, which is the year that Candace leaves New York City. So I thought that was like, I don't know, like when I was reading this book, I felt like it was just written for me. Like so many of my anxieties right now as someone who really doesn't know what to do with her life and kind of like is drifting aimlessly while trying to figure out like job situations and stuff. I definitely like related with Candace. I related with Jonathan, her boyfriend, quite a bit. It was a little bit depressing. It was like looking into a mirror and kind of being like, ah.
Well, I mean, if you look at Jonathan and Candace, those are two, like, I know two of those people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like, that's like, you know, that's like our generation. Yeah. You either like,
you're either a Candace or you're a Jonathan.
You're either an office drone and you're just doing it for money, but you have lost all meaning in your life. Yeah. Or you're like Jonathan. You think you have meaning, but you refuse to be a cog in the system, but you suffer.
But also I've heard like, so there's that chapter where they've already separated, but they go to get, I think, was it Puerto Rican food or something?
They went to go get food.
During a hurricane, which is such an East Coast thing to do. Like,
Oh my God.
Do you remember hurricane parties?
Oh my God, no. Every year in college, there was a hurricane party. Yeah. There was that one big hurricane that hit New York City and almost 90% of the city was gone because it was predicted to be like a really, really big storm. And I actually got into a fight with Dan. This was Dan and I were only dating for a couple months. And at the time of the storm, I was supposed to stay with him in ABCville because we were supposed to cat sit. But then I was like, I don't know, this is going to be a really big storm. And I don't really want to be in the city when this happens. And I didn't really want to stay in my apartment either because our apartment was right by the Hudson River.
Yeah.
So if the storm came, our apartment would be hit. Our neighborhood would be hit pretty hard. And I looked at the flooding zones and I was just like, no, this is not happening. I'm going to Jersey. I'm going to Princeton with my roommate and you can come along. And we kind of got into a fight like that. But it just seems like storms really bring in your priorities in check, you know?
I don't know. I mean, as a young person, there's that sense of any reason for a party, right? And you kind of get that with in the story, let's have a party since your mom left us a shark fin, right?
Yeah. I feel like I went to a lot of parties like that.
Yeah.
I think it's just like a thing amongst millennial New Yorkers.
But going back to Jonathan and Candace, Candace is someone I was almost that. When I got out of college, I fell into a job. I worked at a major Hollywood studio, but I was doing home entertainment. I was in charge of getting DVDs on the shelves of your Best Buys and your Myers and your Sam's Clubs. And I was in charge of coordinating manufacturing to transportation to managing inventory, right?
And every day, did you think life is meaningless?
Well, but it was good money.
Yeah, of course.
And you kind of say, okay, I'm not that bad at this. I could see myself taking this as far as I can go, but I was also feeling very because it's a very, I don't know if it's a millennial thing, because I don't know if our parents felt this.
I'm sure our parents have felt it, and I'm sure kids nowadays feel it.
Yeah.
It's like this burnout culture of you always have to constantly be working.
Yeah.
And if you're not working, you're deemed worthless.
Yeah. But then you're learning the nitty gritty of because this is something that consumer culture tries to actively cover up, is the amount of labor and work that goes into everything you consume, whether it's food or your DVDs or your Bibles, right? Even the books that we read come from, you have to source the paper, you have to source the person binding it, you have to create the, there's a lot of labor that goes into stuff you buy, but you want to buy it for cheap. So it creates this race-to-the-bottom economy that the world is seeing right now that's being exasperated by, whatever trade war we're in right now. And it's really interesting that was a big part of this story, is kind of her learning, all the steps of making, Bibles, pretty much.
Yeah, well, making
the best-selling
anything.
Book of the world.
Yeah, because it's not just with books. She can tell with bags and stuff. She's okay, this was made in China, Bangladesh.
Yeah.
This is the amount of people who had to work overtime for such little pay to get this little thing for some rich person to buy here. So there is definitely a lot of cynicism.
Yeah. And the fact that she ends up falling into this job and sticks with it because doing the same thing over and over again, going to work every day, is preferable to her than not knowing what's going to happen, right? Especially
since she's an orphan, too.
Yeah.
She doesn't have her parents, rely on. And even if she has their money, it's she knows that is, a limited time. And, her father would probably not want her to squander it on just doing nothing.
Yeah. And we can talk about the children of immigrants part of this.
Oh yeah, that was definitely one of my favorite parts of this book.
Yeah.
But I did want to jump back to Candace, like, feeling comfort in doing these repetitive tasks.
Yeah.
She actually tries to quit her job at the one-year mark, and her boss is like, listen, you're really good at this. And, you know, like, some people aren't lucky enough to work their dream jobs, and why not, like, like, you're good at this, like, you're lucky to have, like, a good-paying job. And that kind of, like, deters her from, I don't know, she's like, this isn't my forever job, but I also don't know what I want to do with my life. So I guess this is the better option, the safer option.
And historically speaking, this was a time, like, this would have been 2008. Like, the financial crisis was hitting.
That is the worst.
And so it makes sense. Like, back then, like, there was a lot of uncertainty. Like, this book is an alternate history, right? Because it takes place in the breakdown takes place in 2011. And I thought it was really funny that in this world, Occupy Wall Street just, like, dies in like a week, you know, because the world has bigger problems to worry about than, like...
I was surprised that Occupy Wall Street, like, made it into the book.
I mean, it was such a crystallizing event for a lot of millennials, I feel like.
I know.
You know?
But I was just, like, surprised. I was like, oh, right. Like, this is alternate history.
Yeah.
Like, stuff that actually happened in our universe actually happened here. So I was surprised.
One thing that I really, like, I thought about was how... So we've talked before about the experience of being a young millennial in New York, right? And it reminded me of something my cousin told me once, because she lived in New York for a while. People don't live in New York. They put up with New York to be there.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And at some point, and this has happened to a lot of my friends who do live in New York, at some point you have to leave because New York does not – it's not sustainable. It does not – want you there. It wants the next person to come in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you move to Jersey, you moved upstate to, like, start families and, like, settle down. You're still a New Yorker, quote unquote, but you're not in New York anymore.
Yeah. Well, right? New York now is just so gentrified that no one can afford to live there. And it's just become like I visited not that long ago and you visited not that long ago too. And it was just a big shock to me because I the last time I went and like the time before it was like a 3-year gap.
Oh.
And I was just like, why are all these Asian brands like in like 34th Street? Like they did not exist before. And it was just so many like so much globalization happened. And I was like, this is New York City. I thought. Like, you
also,
know,
Whole Foods are everywhere now.
I know. That was just like really weird to me. And like at a certain point, it's gotten to be like this playground for just like the super privileged and rich. And it's always kind of been like that. But like now it feels like it is so palpable there. Like, I remember when Brooklyn was still a place for like a lot of creative artists. But now it feels like it's Manhattan. Like, it has gentrified so quickly.
You gotta go further south.
That is true. I mean, most of my friends now live in, like, Jersey City or, like, outside of Queens. Because now, like, Queens is slowly being developed as well.
And I thought it was really interesting that, like, the flashback story is kind of that arc where basically... all of Candace's friends and coworkers are leaving New York because it becomes unsustainable for them. And in this case, it's not because of rising rents, it's because of,
you know,
the outbreak of the zombie apocalypse. But she kind of puts her head down and says, if I keep working, this will pay off. And it's like, it's such a relatable thought that, like, if I just put my head down and work, I'll be able to do whatever I want later. But I have to do this now. It's like kind of this, like, you focus on, like...
you focus on the results, the payout, instead of, like, the process. And, like, you know, like, it's kind of ridiculous because you're in a post-apocalyptic setting.
Right.
But capitalism still reigns.
And it's such – because, like, everyone around her saying, you've lost your mind. Like, why are you still here? Why are you still doing this? There's no one – you're not doing this for anyone anymore. You're just doing work for work's sake. And it reminds me of people who, like, stay in, like, these, like, more – maybe not even toxic situations, but, like, not optimal situations with the belief that things will get better if they just finish it. Or just, like, you know, during that whole period where you know, after like she and Jonathan break up and she decides to leave New York, she is essentially, her actions in a vacuum is pretty much the same as like a fevered, right? And we haven't talked about what the fevered
what
are.
What the fevered
in this
are,
book.
But yeah, like I think that's the part where the horror really like seeped into the book. It's like, oh, this is our life. Like we don't need to like have a zombie apocalypse for us to be in the same like live or die situation as like Candace.
Like at a certain point, she literally moves into her office. Like she lives at work.
Okay, so here's the thing. Like a lot of offices are doing that now, where like they provide like, they're like, oh, we have like a break room and we have places where you can take naps. And I'm like, no. Like, get rid of all of that and pay your employees the money that you're going to spend on buying all of those things.
It's like barracks for factory workers, right? And like, that's how things are in Asia and Southeast Asia.
Asia,
when those factories, like, people live at work.
Not even like factories, just like regular office buildings. Like, so, like, I have a cousin who immigrated here 2 years ago, and she's going to move back soon. But her husband went back to Korea to restart his job. And it was just, like, really, like, I was just, like, really baffled as to why they would stay here for such a short time. And I had asked them, like, I was like, what? Why are you here in America? Like, like, if it's for such a short time, because he was doing some kind of class. And he said, well, in Korea, I would be lucky to see my sons for at least like 2 hours in a day, because that was his job. His job was just like working in an office, and the office had beds, and people were often required to like stay all night.
Yeah.
And that is just like that's not even just factory culture. That is just like workplace culture. And also it's kind of seeped into youth culture. Like kids are so pressured these days to do well, and they're like stuck in like study cubicles, and it's like really, really sad.
And it's like they've been indoctrinated to like expect it.
Yeah,
and
it's like
this is just how you have to listen to your elders. And I guess that's another theme in this book too, is just like there's no reason Candace is doing anything that she does, except that she doesn't want, or she either refuses or just doesn't want to think for herself, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's easier to do, like, repetitive things without, like, worrying about the future, or, like, you know, having a boss tell you what to do with your life and what's best for you in the end. But, yeah, like, the whole mindset of, like, if I do this now, I can be happy later. It is a very toxic way of thinking in working or even studying environment.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's just kind of surpassed all generations at this point.
And it's become such a mindset that like anyone telling you something other than that, you don't listen. Like she actively gets mad at anyone who tells her that she's doing it wrong.
Yeah.
Right.
There was this, I just want to like say this quote, because this is when the hurricane is happening. Mm-hmm. And Jonathan is kind of bewildered at why people are partying, and and she explains to him,
fair point.
Yeah, and she's explaining to him like, oh, this is why they're partying. Day off meant we could do things we'd always meant to do. We just wanted to feel flush with time to do things of no quantifiable value, our hopeful side pursuits, like writing or drawing or something other than what we did for money, like learn to be a better photographer. And even if we didn't get around to it on that day, our free day, maybe it was enough just to feel the possibility that we could if we wanted to, which is another way of saying that we wanted to feel young, though many of us were that, if nothing else.
Yeah, I remember that line.
I felt like it slapped me across the face when I read that. I've kind of had a lot of moments like that reading this book.
That was around the same, like, I think it was either right before or right after that. She was kind of explaining that everyone kind of hoped that the hurricane was bad enough that they can take the next day off, but not bad enough that it disrupted their lives, like disaster style, right? And that kind of, that hoping for something to disrupt is so
relatable.
Yeah.
I feel like that like, that was not even just with hurricanes. It was, like, with rain. It's like, oh, I hope it rains enough today that, like, the roads are bad enough that I'll be able to work from home or something like that.
Do you remember, like, it's like, you know, hoping for a snow day, right?
Oh, I have people in the East Coast still who, like, pray for snow days. And they're like, in their 30s. Because that means that they can work from home.
Yeah. I remember when I was in college, we had almost a week off school because of a huge wildfire in San Diego. It was basically my whole entire school was on alert in case the fire jumped on one of the major freeways. Because if it jumped that freeway, that means we had to evacuate. And I remember I had a paper due on Thursday.
Oh, my God.
And we got Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday off. And we were waiting to see if we could take Thursday off because it was just like it was raining ash. Like you couldn't go out. The air quality was so bad. So we kind of just stayed in and like ran to the cafeteria to like eat, you know. And then it was like 6 p.m. and they sent out the email. School resumes Thursday. I'm like, damn it. So I had to write my paper in that night.
Oh my gosh, Marvin.
It's fine. I got an A.
I mean, that's like college energy right there.
Speaking of, there's so many directions we can go. But I did find it really interesting that the survival group that Candace joins, it felt like everyone there, or at least most of her friends there, had creative degrees.
Oh, yeah. Right? Yeah, you have... that one girl who is pretty much like the media person in like the newsroom where they like make memes and viral clips. And I'm like, oh, my God, I can totally relate as someone who like interned at like these companies that make the young people do the viral and meme stuff. It is it's agony. And then you have, like, the other guy who went to art school and then he went into industrial design, designing, like tampon boxes. And he's just like, I didn't even make the decisions to create those things. I just created the things that they told me to create. Yeah. And they were tampon boxes. And it's like, this is a really sad ragtag group. It's like they find out that, you know, they worked so hard thinking that it will pay out and then nothing matters.
I mean, isn't that the millennial like struggle in like a nutshell?
Yeah.
We're all fed this dream of like we're gonna be, and like we're fed this by the media too. Like we see the stories that they lionize, like the Mark Zuckerbergs and like the Wunderkinds, and we all want to be that. But in truth, we're deciding how to source stuff for a Bible, how to make tampon dispensers. Like you dream of becoming those big shots, and then you end up like even if you work for like a Facebook now or you work for like a media company, you're not doing the stuff that like you're dreaming of. You're doing like let's analyze what keywords work good, or let's A/B test this creative with this creative. And it's like the very like industrial nature of everything we do, even the glamorous stuff like fashion. Like what is fashion? What is a bag? It's a bunch of stuff that like you have to build. The value is in the perception of the brand, right?
Yeah.
But the materials, they're all sourced from, like, you know, Bangladesh, China, Taiwan. Like,
I found it really funny when, like, New York Fashion Week happened in the book where it's like, you know, the Shen fever is in full swing now.
Yeah.
And all of the fashion items that are on the runway are
apocalypse
like...
apocalypse chic.
And, like, scrubs. And I'm like, this is hilarious. And there were just like moments like that in this book that just like it was really depressing because I'm like, oh man, this is my life right now, but also like really, really funny because it would just like it would just kind of hit you when you were not expecting it.
Well, we've gone for a while without talking about the Shen fever.
Yeah, we talked about manufacturing. So let's go to where the Bibles are being manufactured and where this disease got manufactured.
Yeah. I mean, let's start with the disease itself.
Okay.
Which is, it's a fungal infection that, like, what it does to people is it kind of just takes away their free will, pretty much. And basically, what's left is a body with, like, its learned habits that it just loops constantly, right? Whether it's, like, preparing dinners or, like, laughing at, like, shitty sitcoms. And I thought what was really interesting was... the zombies, like, they never use the word zombies. They use the word fevered, right? These fevered are not aggressive, right? They're no danger to anybody. but the survivor group still kills all of them.
Yeah, well, they kill them because they think it's more merciful than letting them live in this loop forever.
Yeah, and not they, but Bob.
But Bob, yeah, yeah, that's, yeah. Well, I feel like Bob indoctrinated like two of the people in their group,
yeah.
Like Alan and...
Well, those are his bros, right? Those
yeah,
are
his bros,
bro followers.
His tech bros.
But...
I thought it was interesting that the fever came from like the Shenzhou region.
Shenzhen, yeah.
Yeah, Shenzhen, yeah.
Yeah, and...
Because that's like a really big like manufacturing...
Yeah.
City, right?
That's where a lot of factories are there. There's a lot more manufacturing hubs popping up in China, but that was like the original. And So in the book, they mentioned that they theorized that the fungus grew out of terrible working conditions in the factories, right? Unventilated rooms, mold that they probably didn't take care of that like mutated and grew and became this epidemic. And like you said, it all wraps back to consumerism, right? And we see this through Candace's interactions with her clients when she's trying to explain, like, the factory's closed, like, it's going to cost more. And then the client's like, no, we don't want to pay more.
Yeah.
Right? Capitalist markets, like, first world countries, consumer-based countries, taking advantage of low-wage work to create their goods and, like, forcing these emerging economies to lower their costs and to, like, in order to, you know, get business causes this epidemic that then comes back and infects the world.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. I like how Ling Ma, like, emphasized that, you know, China is making these goods now, but... like, there will be another country that replaces China with cheaper labor and cheaper ways of, like, getting goods to the West. And it's an endless cycle. But, like, yeah. Shen fever, that I have watched a lot of zombie movies before. I've read my fair share of post-apocalyptic books. But this was kind of like a different type of infection I've never really come across in this genre.
Yeah.
And I thought it was done really, really well. It, like, you feel, I don't know, it's like, it's unnerving. Like,
yeah.
Like, I picture, like, being in, like, an emptied out metropolis, a place where it's teeming with people all the time, knowing where they want to go, always hustling. It's like dead quiet and there's vegetation everywhere. And then you see someone at a Juicy Couture, like, folding clothes, like,
yeah,
repeatedly. And then you look to the side and, like, half of their jaw is missing. And it's like, that is cinematic and that is, like, frightening. And there's, yeah, like, a sense of eeriness to the disease that I haven't really seen in other, like, post-apocalyptic infection disease.
Right. And we're talking about, like, how we were talking about how the story itself is like a parallel to how New York's becoming gentrified and people are getting priced out. And the fact that the New York the New York ideals of, like, hustling, you know, of working all the time, of working overtime, of, like, being, like, honestly, suffering just to be in the city, right?
Like, suffering kind of, to be in the city and also putting value in, it, like, your identity in your work.
Yeah.
It's like, if you don't work, then you're nothing.
Yeah.
If you don't work in a job that doesn't give you all of these things, then
yeah,
you're considered, like, at the bottom of the totem pole.
And great zombie fiction is always a reflection of, you know,
society,
right? And it's like, if you think about how different are the fevered from what Candace and her, like, what New Yorkers were before the infection. The main difference is there's no free will, but was there free will to begin with? Like, was there, like, the society has all, like, society, like, this, the capitalist society, capitalism has already kind of defined what you're going to do and be.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And we've seen, like, works that are inspired by the fears of New Yorkers in like literature and television. Like you have like the AIDS crisis and like throughout the country, but like in New York specifically, we've seen works that take inspiration from that and the fear of like getting infected and fear of prejudice and violence. Like we've seen that in so many other works.
Yeah.
So it was really interesting to see something that was like such like a modern take on our struggles.
Yeah. And it seemed like nostalgia was a big factor in the disease is
memories, living
nostalgia.
In the past. Yeah.
Yeah. And we see a character, we see Ashley, who was one of Candace's friends in the survivor group, return to her childhood home and kind of just instantly become fevered. Right.
Yeah.
Like kind of just being in this familiar surrounding, she developed the symptoms because the disease seems to be triggered by nostalgia.
I don't know if it's triggered by nostalgia. That's a theory that Candace came up with. Mm. But it could have been that Ashley had the symptoms, but it became like more aggravated once she got into her childhood home. Mm. So I don't think it's like triggered. It just escalates it. I don't know. Like, I don't know if that makes sense. Like, but it is. It was like an interesting way to tie into the themes of the book on like how memories beget memories, and it kind of like put like a contrast to Candace's background because Candace doesn't have a home that she can go back to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I guess I can see that. That's another possibility because you do see Bob also start to develop symptoms when he returns to the mall that he
grew up in.
Yeah.
I have a quote, and this is what Candace says about like the fevered versus the survivors. Memories beget memories. Shen fever being a disease of remembering, the fevered are trapped indefinitely in their memories. But what is the difference between the fevered and us? Because I remember too, I remember perfectly. My memories replay unprompted on repeat. And our days, like theirs, continue in an infinite loop.
Yeah.
We didn't really talk about Candace's relationship with the manufacturers in China. I thought it was really interesting that she's a Chinese American going back to China to oversee Chinese laborers make this Bible for her job. And there's just like this disconnect. And I just thought that was like really well done.
I mean, that part reminded me a lot of just like this is a thing that happens. Like a lot of my friends and a lot of like people that I know actually do this. Like they're the liaison between like a major company here and their factories over there. They're contractors. And it was really funny seeing the description of like a Chinese factory visit trip. Because I've been to those hotels. I've eaten at those buffets.
Oh, like, really?
I've done those things. And it's like, it is a thing. Like, there is a whole hospitality industry in Shenzhen, in these major manufacturing hubs that cater to foreign business people coming in. Like, you go to, like, say, like the Hyatt or the Radisson or like, what's the big one? The Fairview. The Fairviews are huge in China. And they have like these big breakfast buffets. And it's split down the middle. This side is all the Western stuff. So you get your omelet bars, you get your cereals, you get your eggs and bacon. And the other side, you have the Asian stuff, the Chinese stuff. You have your baos, you have your like crullers, you have your congee. And it's always like, I always thought it was really funny seeing who gets what. Because you have a couple like adventurers, you know, like dudes who adventure out to the Asian side. But most of them are just eating their like eggs and bacon, right? And just the factory visit and then the pomp and circumstance and I thought it was super interesting how Candace didn't have the because this is her first trip, the one that she describes in the book. And she, at that time, she didn't have the understanding of like the dance that you do with customers, especially between Chinese and foreign business partners. But the fact that once they find out that she is of Chinese descent, right, she's Hua Qiao, as we say, they start like kind of trying to bring her in into like the inside, like kind of.
There's some mad shade thrown at her.
They start playing by different rules then. Because now they know that you're Hua Qiao, because they know that you're of Chinese descent, they start to pull the face and they start to pull like a lot of the more guanxi type of relationships that Chinese have with each other. But then they also they throw a shade because they mention, oh, do you celebrate Chinese New Year? And she says, yeah, I eat mooncakes, which is the wrong holiday that she's explaining. Because you eat mooncakes during mid-autumn, not during Chinese New Year.
Well, when I said shade, it was more of like, hey, like, what are you doing working for a company that exploits Chinese workers? It's like, you know how terrible this industry is and like, you're still choosing to do this job. It was just kind of like, there was just like a little bit of resentment there, which is like fair. But I just thought that I was like, I don't know. It's like a type of guilt tripping that only Asian Americans going back to Asia for like in a position like that will ever feel.
Yeah. Did they do that?
Yeah, they did that. Yeah. Like there was like a, it wasn't Balthazar, which I thought was like a really funny name to pick, but it was like one of the workers in the factory, and Balthazar tells him that Candace is from China, and they're from the same region.
Oh.
And he's just like, well, you know, this is my life. Like my family still lives on the farms and I'm here all the time. And
right. I think that's, yeah. I mean, it's interesting during that part also, like, because even within, and it's a good example of, like, Asians not being monolith and Chinese not being monolith. Because even within China, there are different regions on different levels of that social hierarchy. And the region that Candace's family is from, Fujian province, there's a reason why a lot of the early, like, 1800s immigration to different countries are all Fujianese. It's because they are a port province, or the coastal province, and a lot of them worked as sailors. And so...
It makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, so it makes sense. And I thought it was... it's interesting also, like, people... Like, the people who leave and people who stay, there is resentment. Like, people... That passage where she returns home for the first time in years... And realizes that basically her family are on bad terms with them, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's something that happens a lot because people feel like, oh, like, you're in America. Your life must be so great now.
Yeah. And then the people who moved out here, like her mom, mm-hmm. is just like, oh, man, if I stayed, I would have gotten, like, promoted. I would have, like...
Yeah.
I would have been taking advantage of, like, the economic boom over there. And, like, we wouldn't be looked as, like, foreigners in a country that we live in. And,
yeah
there is, like, a lot of resentment. And it was done in such, like, a relatable, nuanced way. Because I feel like in a lot of like, Asian American films and literature, especially, like, in the early days, it's just a lot of resentment towards, like, your parents being like, you don't understand me, and like the generation gap. But like, but in Severance and in a lot of other works that we read for this book club, it's like very, very nuanced, very, very subtle.
Yeah. And you know, like the title itself, Severance, has a lot of different connotations in the story, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Severance in itself is a corporate term for, you know, when you get fired, right? Here's your severance package. But a big chunk of this book is also the effect of being severed from your home for immigrants, right? And we've seen this in a lot of books that we've read, which is like the moment you leave somewhere, the moment you immigrate somewhere, like you've been disconnected from where you're from, and now you're like something else. Like,
yeah.
Now you're something new. You're not fully Chinese anymore, but you're also not like, you don't automatically become American by being in America.
It's almost like you've cut a part of yourself. Like, you've amputated your Chineseness, for example, but like you still feel like kind of like that phantom limb. It's just like, oh, I am Chinese, but I'm like not like full, like I'm not like what I was before.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think the title was really well done, actually. Anyway, let's talk more about Candace's parents' origins and coming to the country and her relationship with her parents, too. Because, like, I thought it was really intriguing that, like, her dad and her mom had completely different, like, reactions to living in America. Like, her mom constantly wants to go back to China, where, like, her dad is like, no, we are going to consume all of the American things and we're going to stay here because it's not safe back in China. There are more opportunities here. And like, I just thought that was like, I don't know. It's something that I've seen a lot with immigrant families. It's definitely something that I've seen with my family. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why like a lot of the chapters with like Candace and her parents like hit me the most, like it hit it where it hurt. It hurt a lot.
I mean, I think because her dad came to the States for school, and it's interesting that he went to the University of Utah because that's where my uncle went when he came for grad school.
Oh, really?
Like, it was true. Like, the Tiananmen Square incident was a plot point, right? They're actively watching it on TV as it was happening.
Yeah, and like, their reactions are different.
Yeah.
Like, the mom is like, well, this is American news. Like, you don't know. Like, it could be propaganda. And he's just like, no, this is not propaganda. And we are never going back.
He was friends with those, like, some of those, like, yeah, students, right?
Yeah, he was.
Yeah. And I thought it was, like, I thought that was really interesting to bring up because that is still a pretty controversial issue within for foreign relations between you know, the world in China, too.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, China has, at least the mainland, has censored it from their textbooks. A lot of the younger generations don't really know that much detail about it, which is why...
I mean...
it's an ongoing issue.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, it ties in with Hong Kong right now. And
yeah, and the parents definitely weren't your typical Asian parent, like, kind of antagonistic figures that you find in immigrant stories sometimes. I just thought it was really, like, you can tell that she put a lot of, like, that Ling Ma put a lot of care into just, like, writing details that, like, made sense in the book, but to those of us who grew up in, like, specifically a Chinese household, like, you saw, like, the parallels. Like, the fact that, like, a punishment was just to have them kneel in a dark place for hours. True, you know?
Yeah. I think, like, for me, like, I think, like, the more powerful relationship in this book was, like, between Candace's mom and her. There, it's, like, a very, very complicated relationship where when they were living together in China, like, she, like, they were completely different people. And,
yeah.
And once Candace was... separated from her mom and she's being raised with her grandparents, like, it's a style of parenting that is probably not the best, which is like spoiling your kid but also like ignoring them at the same time. And then like when she comes to America and sees like her mom again after the separation, they're again, different, totally different people. They've gone through some things and there's really not a way for them to go back to the way they were before, which is like a mom who is very like, you know, allows her kid to make decisions, make mistakes, but also like provide comfort. And like Candace as a child who is like very trusting and obedient. It's like that relationship doesn't exist anymore. And I think that is something, and like also like Candace mentions that like when her mom was at her, like in her last days, like suffering from Alzheimer's or dementia. I'm not really sure. Remember
early onset Alzheimer's.
Yeah, yeah. And like her mom just kind of like reminiscing on these stories. A lot of them are stories that her mom didn't actually go through. It's like stories that her like her memories are bleeding into her dad's memories and stuff like that. But her mom's like recounting all these stories, and Candace is just like, I really just want to go through all of the transgressions that have happened between us. But, you know, last days are meant for relief and not for like blaming.
Yeah.
And like I thought that was really powerful because especially for like immigrant parents, like you're trying to raise your kid in like an environment that is completely foreign to you. And for a lot of kids who like I guess they're called satellite kids who are raised abroad and then they come to the States after their kids after their parents have enough money to raise them. I think that's the term. I'm not sure.
I'm not 100% sure. I know the opposite is parachute kids.
Oh, yeah. But like I think that was a term that we read in The Leavers by Lisa Coe. But okay. I just feel like that is something that happens a lot in those situations where like you kind of don't know what to do with your child / parent. And you're still trying to figure out your own identities in this strange country. And then there is like a lot of resentment and a lot of pressure for the kid to succeed and to make use of themselves in this country. And
it's also a very like, I think, I don't know if it's unique to immigrant kids, but the idea that like we don't truly understand our parents until we become adults ourselves. And like kind of see how hard it is to be
an adult
in this world. And you start to realize how hard it must have been for them not knowing as much as you do, like not growing up in this environment, like kind of, you know, those of us who are immigrants from like non-European countries, like we grew up always being other. They had to go from being a majority to a minority. And that must have been hard, too.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. I know with like with my parents, it's kind of similar because like, you know, my dad was white collar and that's why we immigrated here for his job. Mm-hmm. And like my mom, if I think about it now, it's like crazy because she was only 30 when she came to this country and she already had two kids.
Yeah.
And
she had a life.
She had a life. And the thing is, like, after she became a mom, like her career was obviously like put on hold because you're taking care of a 3-year-old and like a baby. And I'm revealing a lot of like family drama right now, but I guess I just like want to say that it really did hit me because like I do have that relationship with my mom where like she is a little bit resentful because like if she had stayed in Korea, like she could have had she may have had a prosperous career. My mom majored in classical singing, but when she had me, like her voice got damaged, so she could have made like an easier career transition into music, but we came to America, so that was put on hold. And and then there was a lot of pressure put on me because I am her oldest child, and my dad is never in the house because he is like on business trips or working all the time to make sure that his family is being provided.
Yeah.
So it's like there's a lot of pressure put on me, and I went through a lot of like my mom's neurosis like neurosis activities where it's like you are constantly afraid of like making mistakes or like you're getting yelled at even when you're doing things right because your parent is so scared that you're not going to be able to survive in like this new environment in this new country. And it's like my mom and I have had that talk where I was just like, you have done some shit to me. You have done some irreversible shit to me, but I understand. Like you were very young when you came to this country and you were not prepared to be a parent on top of that. So it's like, for me, like those passages with like Candace and her mom, and even like when her mom comes back as like a ghost helping her escape from the facility.
Yeah.
Like, I think those parts like really, really resonated with me. And like it's really hard for me to be objective about the writing part of that because it did hit me really hard.
Yeah.
So I don't know about you, Marvin, if you actually like thought those scenes were really well written with her mom and her.
I thought it was. I mean, I don't have as much of a personal like relationship. I don't have like that. Like my relationship with my mom is a little
more chill.
More chill, yeah. I mean, the part that really got, like, the parts that I related to the most personally, besides the whole, you know, millennial angst theme of the book, was, like, there's that passage where it's back when she was visiting Sinjin for the first time, and Balthazar, I think, switches to Mandarin on her.
Yeah.
And then she, like, because I'm the same way where, like, I grew up speaking Mandarin with my parents. I took couple years of Saturday school in like Saturday Chinese school, which, you know, did ultimately nothing for learning the language.
Amazing how that works, right? When you're forced to learn something, you do your best to not retain it.
Yeah. So like reading, like I have very rudimentary reading skills. I have non-existent writing skills, but conversationally, I can carry conversation pretty well. But if it goes on for more than 10 minutes, people start noticing that my vocabulary is very basic. Because I have pretty much like a third degree vocabulary. Like I can talk, but I can't use idioms and I can't use like colloquialisms, right? So like it's like you're talking to like a fifth grader maybe level, like where it's like they can hear a conversation, but you know, if I want to, and I think it's that concept of like when I speak Chinese, Mandarin, like up to a certain point, I can think and speak in Chinese. But if the conversation needs to get more nuanced, I think in English and I translate in my head.
And yeah, I thought the translation part was like really, really good in the book. It like expressed it so well where she's just like searching for the word. She's like, oh man, what's the word for immigrate in Mandarin? Yeah. Like, I don't know. So she just like improvises and says, oh, I moved to America. And it's like, and, like, I totally relate to that, too, because my Korean is, like, not great. But, like that moment of just, like, oh, I don't have that right word, so I'm just going to, like, use something that like, I have that is somewhat close to what I want to say.
Yeah.
And her just, like, lying about her dad being, like, a brain surgeon.
Yeah.
I was just like, oh, my God, it's, like, situational comedy. It's gold.
I guess... Let's wrap up our conversation by talking about, I guess, the stakes of the story, which is Bob.
Bob and the facility and the escape. We find out that Candace is pregnant.
Yeah.
And I don't know about you, but I knew that she was probably pregnant.
I mean, they kind of telegraphed that.
Yeah.
You know, and then...
It's a post-apocalyptic book with a female protagonist. The twist is probably the fact that she is pregnant.
Yeah.
That was just like my gut feeling. And I felt so like validated when I got to that twist. I was like, yes, I was right. Yes. The entire time when she was with the surviving, with the group of survivors, I don't know. There was like so much tension.
There was a lot of tension, especially like the moment you realize that Bob is using like religion to like kind
why
of
why is it
control.
Always the crazy white dude who is like into Christianity like at the end of the world, like it's always, they're always the villain.
Well, it's also interesting that like religion is used multiple ways, because it's also used as a way, like kind of like as intended, of a way to build community and like create a safe space for people. Because like Candace's mom finds religion not because she's religious, but because she finds a place where she can feel
it's where all the other Asians are. So
yeah.
You go, like, this is just like a common thing amongst like all Asian immigrant families. There is a church for everyone.
And it's fascinating that we kind of see this as, like, I mean, the way I read it is like religion being used by the colonized and the colonizer.
Yeah.
Right? When Bob is like using religion to assert control. Sure, you build like a community, you build like kind of, you give people stakes to kind of care about each other. But ultimately, it's a means for him to accomplish his agenda.
Yeah. Like his plan was like very, very flimsy when he was like, oh, the facility. I thought it was going to be like a bunker or something, but it was just a mall. And I'm like,
You can't have a zombie narrative without a mall.
You killed people. You like traveled miles and miles across states for a mall. Like, there are malls in other states. I didn't really see.
Right.
Like, I did not understand. Like,
and you picked Chicago, like the place where like there's like brutally cold winters.
That was when I was just like, oh, this guy, like, he's one of those guys who like talk big but have like nothing to.
I mean, that's kind of the character, right? Like, Bob reminded me of those people who like argue a lot online and tries to like tell people how to live their lives. Right, like he's like every person who has shared one of those articles, like why millennials suck.
Yeah,
like, that's Bob. You know,
he's definitely the type of guy where he would comment saying like, "Well, actually, like I like lost my shit." I'm cursing so much in this episode. I lost my shit when he locked up Candace.
Yeah,
and like. In, like, the skincare shop.
And tries to justify, it's like, oh, it's for your own good.
And I'm just like, right? Why is, like, I hate the fact that he is using her pregnancy, like, as his own agenda. As if, like, it's his baby. And it's like, it's not. It's her body. It's her baby. You should not be able to make these decisions. You have no jurisdiction.
Yeah.
And I hate the fact that, like, he's taking advantage of, like, her health to, like... Like, be like, oh, you're not going to escape because you're pregnant. Like, what are you going to do? Like, yeah. I hate that, like, level of like, scheming.
Yeah.
And it's something that, like, that's happening right now with, like, in America with, like, reproductive rights. And also with just, like, I don't know, like, yeah. Well, I was glad that he was fevered. I kind of guessed that he would get fevered because of Ashley when she got fevered in her home.
Well, yeah, because there was that scene where Candace was, you know, she's trying to gain his trust, right? That's when he moves her to a Sephora upgrade from like the what was the other place she was at? The first place, it was like another cosmetic store. She goes from a smaller cosmetic.
Oh yeah, yeah. She went from like. It wasn't Clinique, but it was like a small skincare shop.
Yeah,
and then got upgraded to a Sephora with IKEA furniture being like sent over.
It is 2011, so there isn't like face shops in like the Korean places.
I feel like the whole time when her mom, like when she mentions like the skincare routine, like her mom being like, "Oh, the 3-step Clinique routine," and I'm like, 3 steps. Okay, we are now at like 13 steps in the Korean skincare routine. And then by like 2011, it's like the 10 steps. So it's just like, lady, you're behind.
I mean, they were in
they were in Utah. I can
Well, I mean, yeah.
Just something that my mom always says too. She's like, always put sunscreen on. Always, like, you always have to do skincare because you're not going to stay young forever. Once you turn, once menopause, it's over for you.
Yeah. Bob sucks, I guess, is the point of this whole segment.
He, like, I don't know, like, him using religion, him, like, not having a plan, him using Candace's pregnancies for his own agenda. It was just like,
yeah, and him just not taking responsibility for anything. Like, he literally drove Evan to suicide, like, allegedly, right?
Allegedly.
And he, you know, you can tell from the text that, like, he doesn't have any idea what he's doing. He just knows he needs to be in control. He wants to do what he does. Because, like, there's no, like, if he was truly someone who was thinking about the group, there's no way he would have led them to a mall in Chicago.
No.
You know?
No, and, like, his grand plan is just like, oh, look at the stuff. Look at all the stuff. Like, just take everything and, you know, just hoard it. And maybe we'll survive this winter. And it's like...
Yeah, I mean, if the plan was to, like, go to a colder climate because that's where the fungus isn't as, you know, rampant... You're in New York already. Just go north. Go to Vermont.
Or go to Buffalo.
Yeah. So let's talk about the ending.
The ending.
Where she finally escapes by, like, kind of taking advantage of Bob's fevered state and, like, kind of beating the crap out of him.
Oh, man. I felt so good. Felt so good reading that. I'm like, yes. Because like when she
gets angry, like
yeah,
she,
when
like
she figures out that he's fevered, she's like, oh hell yes, and she like beats the crap out of him, and I'm like, yes, all that anger, all that like frustration you had to keep while you were locked up for over a month. I cannot believe she was locked up for in a skincare shop for like over 3 weeks. But the ending where she steals the car and she's heading
to Chicago.
Yeah.
And she pretty much like drives that car until it's empty.
Yeah, she like I thought what was really interesting is like she thinks that she's heading to Chicago because that's where Jonathan's from, mm-hmm. but then she remembers that she actually went to Chicago once before with her parents.
Yeah, do you think she makes it?
I don't think that's really the point. I read on Goodreads that a lot of people were like mixed on the ending. Some people were like, "Oh, it's just kind of like too open-ended." And other people were just like, no, it's fine. It, like, fits the theme of the book.
I think it's, again, going back to how this whole book is, like, an allegory for millennial young adulthood, right? And, I mean, if you look at the story in context, it's pretty much someone who is chewed up and spit out by the city of New York and ends by starting anew somewhere else, like Chicago. Because, like, you know, that's kind of – that's how a lot of my friends from – like, who lived in New York for a while, that's kind of how their lives ended up, is they worked there until they couldn't work there anymore. And then they go come home to L.A., move to Seattle, move to Chicago, move somewhere else where they begin the next phase of their lives.
Yeah.
Right? With, like, uncertainty.
Yeah, yeah. It is, like – it is very relatable. And – you know, I kind of like the fact that she went to another city.
Yeah.
Because I thought her photo project was really, really cool. And and like her posts, like her captions for her posts for New York Ghost were really, really funny. And
she might have been a really good social media person at a meme site.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, like she had that project before she moved to New York. And it's like it was like really nice that like that kind of tied in, and she's continuing to do it now. And now she's starting a new chapter in like another city.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think I'll ever move back to New York. I feel like I left at the right time, to be perfectly honest. The trains absolutely suck. They catch on fire. There's a lot of issues with, like, rent and also just, like, a sustainability over there. But I think with a lot of people who lived in cities right after graduating high school, or like the first city that they moved to, without like the first city that they moved to lived alone, like that's such like a cornerstone in growing up, you know. It's just like that's when you first become a person. That's actually a quote in the book.
Say that was a line in the book.
And like to me, like that was New York. I graduated from high school. I moved from Georgia to New York City. And to me, like, I always wanted to go to New York City for school. That because I lived in New Jersey before, and I was like I went to the city like somewhat often, and that was like to me, I was like, oh, this is a city for people who are ambitious and who can, you know, be anything. And there's so much history. So like for me, I kind of was bought into this idea of New York City rather than like the grim reality of like there are rats. there are rats, there are homeless people, there are a lot of drug issues that are happening with successful people. Like it's stuff that you don't really hear when you're a kid.
But, I mean, that's what New York is selling. This is where, like, this, the whole thing, if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere.
Yeah, if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere.
And,
yeah, but I look at my time in New York with, like, rose-colored glasses. Like, I really did have fun, and I think I did grow up a lot there. But like you said, I cannot, like, I left because I just couldn't live there anymore.
Yeah.
And now I live in another city. And I also want to leave this city and start a new chapter in a different city. But it's hard to even move from city to city anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's...
Was Washington, D.C.? Was D.C. your first city?
I'd say more San Diego.
San Diego?
Yeah. D.C. was kind of another leg of that. But I wouldn't say D.C. Like, I wouldn't call myself a D.C. person.
I wouldn't call myself a New Yorker. I don't even call myself an L.A. person, and I've lived here for a long time now.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely, like, the fact that we could talk about so many things about this book that has little to do with the zombie apocalypse.
Yeah.
Shows that we really like this book and it really spoke to us as to, you know, myself, a children immigrant, and you, like, an immigrant / children of immigrants, like...
Oh, yeah, I love that hyphen. Childhood, yeah.
I mean, technically, I am an immigrant, too, because I was born in Canada, technically.
Or, like, generation 1.25.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
It definitely, like, it was a great story, but also, like, it's a great Asian American story.
See, that's the thing. That's the thing. Like, I've seen this book listed as, like, best books of 2018 because it came out in 2018. And, like, you know, a lot of these magazines, they're, you know, not just Asian American magazines. Yeah. They're like, oh, this is, like, so this resonates with anybody who's a millennial or anybody who's burnt out with, like, the work culture. But then for us, because we're Asian American, because Ling Ma put so much thought and care into crafting Candace's character as well as, like, the other Asian American characters in this book, like, to us, like, I feel like it's, like, even more poignant to our demographics. I don't know. It's just, like... I said this earlier in the podcast, but I felt like this book got me, like, like I feel like I ticked all of its boxes for its demographic. And it's always great when you have a book that is, like, tailored for you.
Yeah, for sure.
Anyway, we have talked a lot about this book, but we definitely want to hear your thoughts. I totally forgot to put a Goodreads post on this book in our forum, but I will start one so you guys can...
By the time you hear this episode, there will be a post on our Goodreads forum. We'd love to hear what you thought, what you related to, anything we missed, because I'm sure we missed a bunch. It wasn't the longest book, but it was definitely gave us a lot of material to talk about. So we are looking forward to anything you all can share as well. But yeah, I guess I'll do it for this discussion of Severance by Ling Ma. If you haven't read this book yet and you're intrigued by our conversation, go read it. You won't be disappointed, especially for our Asian American listeners out there.
Yeah. And for our September 2019 book club pick, we are going to be reading Everything Here is Beautiful by Mira T. Lee. Again, that is Everything Here is Beautiful by Mira T. Lee. And just a content warning, there is, I think one of the main characters has schizophrenia or developing schizophrenia. So mm-hmm. there is mental illness and just go into it with caution.
Okay.
And next month, or I guess like in a couple days, because we're at the end of August, Books and Boba is going to turn 3. We started this podcast in September 2016.
Wow. Has it been 3 years? That means we've read, what's 12 times 3? 36 books.
36 books at the very least, because we have read books for book interviews. And
that's
also
true.
Also, you've read books that had nothing to do with the month's pick because you
officially
just felt like it.
Officially, the book club has 36 official picks.
Yes.
So thank you all for supporting us. Thank you all for, especially those of you who have been reading along since the beginning, thank you for, you know, continuing to listen to us. And
I hope that this podcast has thoroughly debunked the myth of there are not enough Asian American Asian authors because I feel like every month that we do this podcast, I'm like, well, there you go. There's another one.
And on that note, that'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba as well. Thank you all so much for listening. If you haven't done so yet, go read Severance. It's so good. All right. Talk to you next time, Rira.
All right.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This episode was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu and produced and edited by Marvin Yue. This podcast was recorded at the Potluck Podcast Studios located within the Visual Communications offices in downtown Los Angeles. You can learn more about Visual Communications and their programs such as the Los Angeles Asian Pacific Film Festival by going to the website at vcmedia.org. Thanks also to the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts that Books and Boba is a proud member of. You can learn more about our fellow Potluck podcasts by checking out the website podcastpotluck.com.
Hey, I'm Phil Yu, and you may know me from a blog called Angry Asian Man.
And I'm Jeff Yang, author, journalist, and celebrity dad.
We host a podcast called They Call Us Bruce, an unfiltered conversation about what's happening in Asian America.
Each week or so, we host a discussion about some of the most vital and interesting topics in our pop culture and our community, bringing in guests who are shaping and informing this thing called Asian America from Hollywood to D.C. and beyond.
We got media, entertainment, food, family, politics, representation.
The good, the bad, the WTF of it all.
So check us out wherever you get your podcasts or at theycallsbruce.com.
Peace.
Peace.